Welcome to Forest North, a podcast from the Superior National Forest. I'm your host, Brett Ross. Join me as we talk with some of the great people who live, work, and recreate on our national forest lands here in northern Minnesota. Forest Service wilderness crews are a vital part of the management of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Tom Yankoviak from the LaCroix Ranger District and Chris Mayer from the Kowishui District manage those wilderness crews. And today they join us to talk about some of the nitty-gritty of the job, including everything you never knew you wanted to know about latrines. Forest North is created by the Ely Tourism Bureau in partnership with the USDA Forest Service Superior National Forest. Find out more about the Superior National Forest at fs.usda.gov/superior. Remember to subscribe, share, and leave a review on your favorite listening platform, and email your comments, questions, or suggestions to tourism@ely.org. I'm Brett Ross. Welcome to Forest North. On this episode of Forest North, I am joined by Tom Yankoviak and Chris Mayer, both wilderness operations leads. Tom is with the LaCroix Ranger District. Chris Mayer is with the Kowishui Ranger District. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for being here today. If we could, right off the bat, Tom, if you could give us a little bit of your background and then talk about what your position with Forest Service entails.
Sure. Well, if we go way back, I grew up on a farm down in central Minnesota, Mora. So grew up paddling on the Snake River, smashing canoes and rapids, stuff like that. Then went up to Vermilion Community College back in 1990. Actually worked on the wilderness crew as a wilderness aide out of Kowishui back in 91, back when it was all aluminum canoes and little half-inch foam sleeping pads and heavy paddles and way worse gear than we have now. I remember getting yelled at because I put a scratch in the brand new aluminum canoe.
Ooh.
Yeah. But after that, I bounced around out west a little bit. I worked for a trail crew on the Gunnison National Forest and worked for Crater Lake National Park, YCC crew lead for a season. Eventually found my way back to Minnesota, got a job as a crew lead on LaCroix Ranger District in 96. So did the Wilderness Ranger thing for 20 plus years. Then in 2017, transitioned to the Wilderness crew lead, Wilderness Operations. So been doing that ever since.
Excellent. Very good. Chris, how about you?
Thanks, Brett. Yeah, so I grew up also in southern Minnesota, down by Rosemont area, and grew up paddling on the Cannon River, just south of Rosemont for a little bit. And then in 95, I started coming up to Ely to a canoe tripping camp and ran that program as a camper and then a counselor for a brief minute up until about 2002. And that really put the bug in my bum, so to say, of getting up to Ely full-time. And so I moved up to Ely full-time in 2002 and spent, about 10, 11 years kind of bopping around, doing some canoe guiding, some canoe outfitting, got really into running sled dogs up in the Boundary Waters and Quetico area and made a career out of that. And then about 10 years ago, or it's 11 years ago, my wife and I moved up to Interior Alaska and worked for the Park Service for the last 10 years. And that thought of a sunset on a lake in northern Minnesota never left the back of my head, even with all the mountains that we were surrounded by in Alaska. And last year, my wife and I moved back down to Ely, and I took the job for Kowishui Station as their wilderness operations supervisor.
Not many people can say they moved down to Ely.
That's true. And I've had a lot of questions about that. I mean, I will say Alaska is big and beautiful, but it's not northern Minnesota when it's all said and done.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
So talk about what responsibilities a wilderness operations lead or wilderness operations supervisor has on the forest.
It's a good question. I think Tom and I are kind of both share that duty for our respective districts. I'd be kind of curious to see how what I do differs from Tom's duties. I've been blessed with a pretty amazing crew of rangers that I work with. And so my job's frankly pretty easy. I line out the crew for scheduling and for projects. Do a lot of purchasing for gear. I think Tom mentioned all the old gear that we used to use. Now we're kind of revamping that stuff into more modern, user-friendly, comfortable gear. And then more of a big picture thing as well is I'll scope out projects in the wilderness, be it doing some portage work or some rock work or some rehabbing things. And so it's a bit of a jack of all trades. A normal day in the summertime may see me running shuttles for people or leaving for an 8-day trip or doing a bunch of paperwork or doing some scheduling. It's kind of the nitty gritty of what I'm doing.
All right. Sound about right, Tom?
Yeah, pretty much sums it up. But yeah, big shout out to the crews. Kudos. We've got some really good crews across the forest now, really good crew on LaCroix Ranger District. Yeah, not just anybody is cut out for it. Take some grit to go out there and sleep on the ground all summer, feed the bugs, you know, mud, rain, week after week, year after year. So yeah, really blessed with a good crew right now. And I try to get out there whenever I can. I get excited when somebody gets sick and they need somebody to fill in on the crew, and I'll even things out for them. So I still get a handful of trips in a summer, but you know, not as much as I used to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Most people who are familiar with the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness are aware of the restrictions, motor restrictions, which covers a lot of different things when you talk about motors, you know, not just motor boats, but chainsaws, any kind of mechanized devices in there. The Forest Service crews that work in the Boundary Waters are not exempt from those rules. You follow those same principles when it comes to work crews that are in the Boundary Waters.
Yeah, the tools are a big part of it. We use what you call traditional tools, crosscut saws, axes. And honestly, they make more sense than lugging a chainsaw around out there. A good crosscut saw, you know, I've got a nice little saw I picked up at an antique shop 20-some years ago. I tuned it up. It weighs about 3 pounds, about a 4-foot saw. I go through it every couple of years and give it a good sharpening. And for the type of work we do out there on a day-to-day basis, it just makes sense rather than lugging a heavy chainsaw out there and chaps and oil and fuel. I can, with another person on the other end of the saw, I can cut through a 10-inch log in less than a minute. And at the end of the day, you're less tired, you know, and for the normal day-to-day stuff we do out there. But no, the crews take pride in their tools. Keep that axe razor sharp. We carry good, you know, Grands Forest Bruck Swedish axes out there, keep them razor sharp. But yeah, most of my crew sharpens their own crosscut saw now. I've got them doing that, so I don't have to do it as much. But yeah, traditional tools are huge out there.
I agree with you, Tom, on that. I think, you know, we're seeing an influx. You know, Chris, we still use a lot of crosscut saws, some 4-footers and some 5- and 6-foot misery whips as well. We are seeing kind of influx of these Japanese blades, the silky saws, and they're really great. I mean, they come out of the box wicked sharp. They're pretty user friendly, pretty easy to maintain and all that. I will say in a pinch across the board, at least for my crew, if it was between, you know, a Japanese silky saw or that traditional crosscut saw, we're going to go for the crosscut saw. It's just, even with a little heavier, it cuts better, and it's really hard. You know, with a good crosscut team, you can make that saw sing. And I have yet to make a Japanese silky saw sing. It's hard to beat a singing crosscut.
And so with the crosscut saw, it's basically a 2-person operation, right?
More or less, yeah. I mean, they are shorter saws or short 4-foot saws. You can run it with one person. And that sometimes makes sense, more or less. But I'd say, at least for us, you know, 95% of the time, we're running either a 4-foot or a 5- or 6-foot saw with two people. Just more efficient, less wear and tear in your body, and makes for a safer cut.
As long as both people are holding up their end of the saw, right?
Good point. Good point.
Yeah, you get a rhythm going. You definitely, you know, there's a little push and pull and maybe a little bit of cussing starting out, and you're pushing down too hard. But after a while working with somebody, you really get a good rhythm going. And it's just the saw does all the work. You're not even tired at the end of the day, hardly.
And I imagine that can do a lot towards team building as well. When you've got two people working on a saw, both people have to really hold up their end to make it work well.
I believe it's a German wedding tradition where the bride and groom have to pick up a crosscut saw at the ceremony and make a cut through a log and get through it cleanly without cussing each other out.
Yeah.
And yeah, seems about right.
I've been on some wilderness adventures with my partner, and we've said to each other after coming out of there, like, this is before anybody gets married, you should have to go on a wilderness adventure like this and see how you come out of it. And if you're laughing about it at the end, then you're going to be okay.
Exactly.
Yep. Exactly.
And then I'll add to that, though, you mentioned, non-mechanical means, once in a great while, we get a large blowdown event. Mm-hmm. We're kind of overdue for one now. It seems like every few years. But if it's bad enough and there's widespread blowdown, thousands of trees down, they will sometimes give us temporary authorization mm-hmm. to bring chainsaws in. And that's a good thing, too. I think back to the 99 blowdown.
Right.
And what was it, about 300,000 acres affected? I was happy to pull out my chainsaw there. I spent about a month on Trout Lake after that, just in that area. I figure I burnt close to 100 tanks of saw gas trying to just open the campsites and portages just in that area. So yeah, events like that, for sure. Sometimes we make exceptions, but for the most part, traditional tools were out there with just our crosscut saw, an axe, a shovel, and a brushing tool. That's our basic tool kit.
Let's talk about some of the details about what the crews do. What are some of the standard jobs that you'll send crews into the wilderness for?
Yeah, good question. So we run an 8-day hitch. So 8 days on, 6 days off. And we stay pretty true to that schedule. So in our normal 8-day hitch, we're going to send out usually a pair of rangers. We always travel at least in a pair or more. Sometimes we'll do 4 to 6 people, but for efficient travel and for the bulk of our work, 2 rangers, 1 canoe, packs and tool bags works for us. And so your normal day is going to be a mixture of public contacts. We try to talk to a lot of visitors, be it checking permits or just checking out the area. I mean, they're some of our best eyes and ears on the ground as far as what maintenance may need to be done that we just haven't seen yet or haven't gotten a chance to paddle by yet. So we'll do a lot of visitor contacts. And then in the springtime, at least, we'll do a lot of basically hitting every single campsite on a lake. And we'll do a quick inventory as far as, with the water and the ground still being high, too high to dig latrines, or things like that, or if before the leaves kind of bush out, we have to start brushing. We'll do a quick inventory of what has to be done, be it digging latrines, if we have to cut down some hazard trees or do some tree mitigation for safety on those campsites, we'll do that or make a note of it. We'll maintain those fire grates as well. Those fire grates are maybe about 60 pounds a hit for the top, and the legs are around 15, 20 pounds or so. And so it's a big deal if we have to replace a fire grate. And so if we see one that's going to be going, we make that assessment as far as, it can last the rest of the summer and we'll haul that out by a dog team in the wintertime. Or if it's more of a stop and fix, we may have to draw that short straw and haul out, roughly 80 pounds of metal out in the woods and muck with that at a campsite. Besides just kind of bopping around, meeting people and chatting with folks and doing inventories of campsites, we'll also do a fair amount of portage work as well. So all the portage trails we have, be it in LaCroix District or Kouishoui or Tofty or Gunflint, they're all maintained by hand. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our day are spent brushing out those trails, making that walking tread wide enough so that someone portaging Duluth packs in a canoe can walk down that trail and not have face whippers and knee whippers and all that. So a lot of time, as Tom had mentioned earlier, cutting up and bucking up blowdown trees on those trails as well to make them passable. And then we'll start making notes and start doing some work as far as ways to, do that erosion control so we don't have those portage trails be a river when it rains and we don't have that hard-fought gravel we're looking for get washed away in the lakes. So that's kind of a rough day. You want to add anything at all, Tom, to that?
Yeah, I mean, I could just add that a lot of those portages were built back in the 30s by the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, especially over on the West End where they had a little more fill to work with. And so if you look close at those, you'll see the old prism of the portage with the ditches and raised tread. And they meticulously put in these, beautiful old rock culverts and treadway turnpikes. And so we're trying to maintain those portages, maintain the alignment of those portages. And that's a large reason why we do the brushing, to keep people on, you know, the raised tread portion of that portage and not walking in the muddy ditch of it. So yeah, they really did some good work back in the day. But yeah, that kind of sums it up just as far as campsite maintenance go. Yeah, a lot of hazard trees out there. Trees just get beat up, you know, from use out there and just through natural attrition. And we will take them down if they're deemed a hazard, you know, looming over a campsite, and, you know, with the axe and crosscut saw. And the crews have some skill there. It takes some skill to tip a tree over, directionally fell it on a campsite in the Boundary Waters with sometimes small targets. So yeah, a lot of hazard tree operations out there. Yeah, latrines. We get a lot of questions about latrines when we pull up on a campsite.
Yeah,
you know, people are kind of confused about it, so we better clear some of that up.
Well, I was curious about it myself. That was actually going to be my next question. Let's talk latrines.
Yeah, everything you wanted to know about latrines, but we're afraid to ask. So yeah, a lot of people look at us and they look at the shovel and they're like, "Ooh, you dig those out, huh?" And I'm like, "No, we don't actually dig them out. We just move them. We'll go to a new location, usually in the vicinity of the old latrine. We try not to go too far, utilize the existing trail, and we'll give the old hole a proper burial. You know, we'll cap it off good with fill and usually throw some rotten logs on it." So if you see something like that out there, it's not buried treasure. Don't try to dig something up. But yeah, we try to cap it off. And we dig them just with a good old number two shovel. Works mm-hmm. pretty good. You know, you get good at poking around and probing around and just eyeballing a good location for a latrine. On the west end, LaCroix District, we're blessed with a little more soil, I think, than Chris has to deal with over here in Ely and the east side. Unfortunately, it's a lot of clay too, which isn't best for drainage, but it works. We get them as deep as we can, you know, 3 or 4 feet is generally what we're shooting for. I think the record is around 6 feet on the district, but it gets to be a safety thing and you don't want to drop your car keys in there. What else?
How often do you find that you're changing locations for latrines out there?
I was doing the math and I figure we're digging 5 to 10% of the latrines on average on LaCroix District a summer. We've got just shy of 400 campsites and we're, you know, we're digging 20 to 40 a summer. So some are making it forever. I mean, mm-hmm. some still have the original holes on some of the sites that don't get much use, and others are almost every year, depending on the site. So sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say the same over in Cushway as well. I mean, the big factor for us is, you know, the farther you get away from an entry point, the less maintenance we're seeing. So let's say you put in at Moose Lake, we'll say. So Ensign Lake is a pretty popular lake that we'll have people on Ensign Lake probably every week this summer, just doing maintenance work to it, doing those latrines, doing that campsite stuff. The farther you get, I mean, there are latrines on Basswood that have raspberries growing out of them right now. And so it really will vary a lot. I find that the prettier the campsite, if it's on that perfect point with the wind, you know, blowing the bugs away and the sunset and all the things you're looking for, all those boxes are checked, you're going to be going to that campsite to do that latrine maybe once a year sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, those kind of back in the hinterlands where it's not a great view, but there's plenty of tent pads and all that. You might see it hit, you know, once every couple of years tops or so, but definitely the closer those entry points you are, you're going to see more people obviously. And folks do have to use the bathroom every day usually. So we're finding more work on those front country areas.
Yeah. And fun fact, there's still two original wooden latrines on LaCroix District that I can think of. You know, I don't know if those of you that have been going out there for a while remember the old cedar boxes, mm-hmm. and we've been steadily replacing those over the years, but there's still one on Pecan Lake and one on Maxine Lake. So if you want to go, you know, see them before they're gone, have at it.
And Chris, as Tom mentioned, the amount of soil on the Lac La Croix District is definitely not the same as what it is here in the Cushway District.
That's true. And I was hearing Tom was getting 3 or 4 a foot for a hole. I have to admit, I was pretty jealous, frankly. And and most of my crew's pretty jealous. I would put it this way. I was on a latrine digging trip last September, and we did 5 latrines in 5 days, and we had a hard fought 20 inches average for those depths. And it wasn't like, you know, you're digging away and you have like some boulders and all that. It's like you're digging away and you hit like a piece of just ledge rock that runs the whole length, whole width of the latrine. So we had a few times where we'd like backfill that hole, like, well, you know, we'll find a different place. And so we'd go to a different place. And at that point, you're, you know, starting to try, you know, try to like figure out your distance from water. Also, I try to go for a decent view for a latrine as well, so you can have some sort of view, you know, not just, just seeing balsam trees and all that. But Kwishwe is, with the rock, there are certain latrines that we've had. One of our rangers last year did a 6-foot deep latrine over in Lake One area, and that's still talked about on the crew. Actually, we had seasoned paddlers out in the boundary waters stop and say, like, who dug that latrine over on campsite so-and-so on Lake so-and-so? And I was like, oh, it was so-and-so. Wow.
It's impressive.
So once you're out in the woods for a bit as a visitor and you start, you know, noticing kind of the behind the scenes work that has to be done, you have a bit more appreciation for what we're working with. But yeah, we're definitely in a rock belt here, which is great for doing erosion control. We have plenty of rocks to play with for shoring up shorelines and rebuilding fire pits and fire grates and all that. It does make for hard-earned holes to dig. Mm-hmm. I will say that for sure. And we're apt to do a real good look at that latrine. Like, well, do we really have to redig this right now? Like, can it wait another month or so? Just because we have that finite space to do it.
So when it comes to campsites, is there ever a point where you will sort of decommission a campsite or decide that this is no longer a viable place to camp for whatever reason? Does that ever happen, or where you decide to move a campsite from a spot where it's traditionally been?
Yes, I would say a great example is the Pagami fire a couple years ago. With that fire resulted in a couple campsites in that area being decommissioned just due to there's just no trees around it. It just was burned over. And I'd say maybe, and if you want to check me on this, Tom, for sure, please do. In my experience, it's a lot easier to close a campsite than it is to open a new one. There's a lot more, I guess, for lack of better words, paperwork involved. And if we're closing a campsite, it's never due to, oh, it's being used too much. We want folks to use these campsites because they're great spots. And frankly, built them for people to use. So if it is shut down, it's either going to be a safety thing or a resource damage issue, being if a fire washed over and there's, you know, no topsoil left to hold those trees and hold that ground in, or there's no good tent pads any longer, or if there's a bunch of hazard trees that have to be dealt with. So,
yeah. And yeah, Pagami, that sparks a memory. I remember paddling furiously down the shoreline of Lake 3 as the fire was ripping, and we're trying to get to each campsite ahead of the fire to grab the latrine and run it out to the rock so it wouldn't burn up. Wow. So just to save a bunch of future work.
Yeah.
So we rescued quite a few latrines there, but we lost a few too. But yeah, as far as campsites go, over in LaCroix District, we're blessed. We haven't had the big fire events that have forced us to close very many sites. Very few site changes over the years since I've been there. And, you know, in 27 years, I think we've only closed 2 sites and we've opened a couple. But it's enough that, you know, if you've got an old set of maps, you know, 20, 30 years old, it doesn't hurt to check those maps, you know, maybe update them because there could be some changes there. It is hard to close a site just because people have a map that shows a site there.
Right.
And if they pull up and it looks at all like a site, they're going to make it a site again. So it gets pretty tricky. But yeah, rather than closing a site that gets beat up, we do, take on some pretty big rehab projects sometimes on campsites. Chris mentioned big rocks, and that's a good thing. The bigger, the better. We like to get, if one person can lift it, it's not big enough. We use these kind of stretcher systems for big, you know, 1 to 200 pound rocks will set in for erosion control on campsites, things like that. So yeah, a lot of rehab out there like that.
Yeah. I just want to do a quick reminder for all the folks listening. A campsite in the Boundary Waters has to have two very important things to be an active campsite: a latrine and a fire grate. If it's lacking one of those two things, it is not a Boundary Waters campsite. Right. Just a quick reminder for folks, especially if you're new or a first-time paddler around here, even if you have a red dot on your map saying that this should be a campsite here, if this does not have a latrine or a fire grate, those two things, it is not a viable campsite. So,
and an important thing to keep in mind as well, outside of, I guess, outside of the winter season, that fires in the Boundary Waters are only allowed in those approved fire grates.
Great point, Brett. Yeah. And that's a big sticking point, especially with either our high use or low use areas. We want to have, you know, that campfire contained in that fire grate at all times. We don't want to have these big, you know, 4 and 5 foot tall bonfires and all that. We're looking for controllable fires for our campfires.
Yep. And also remember, you know, keep the garbage out of there. Because when we do shovel out those grates, we scatter the ashes, you know, usually back behind the campsite. And if there's little bits of tinfoil and half burnt garbage in there, it makes our job a lot tougher. So, yeah, just clean wood.
Yep. And we've been fortunate, you know, despite the fact that we had one of our least wintery winters that we've ever seen here in Minnesota. We were fortunate enough, especially here in the Ely area, I think we got about 1.5 feet of snow in our most recent snowfall, which definitely helps to cut down on some of that fire danger. But nonetheless, there is a lot of fuel on the ground. So something that is really close to everybody that lives in this region is just being very aware of that fire danger and how you handle fire in the wilderness.
Yep. And that is one of the kind of side duties of the wilderness rangers is you get a busy fire season like that and they will become public safety crews.
Mm-hmm.
So going out there and, you know, talking to folks, possibly directing them. If they're in the path of the fire, closing campsites, closing portages, things like that. So, and helping out just in the suppression of the fire. So
yeah,
they have other duties like that in addition to like search and rescue stuff, you know, other things they can get pulled into. So yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about search and rescue in particular? I know it's inevitable with the number of people that are in the wilderness and just the general hazards of portaging canoes or being on water or, you know, being at the mercy of weather. There's invariably going to be search and rescue situations. Can you talk about how those are handled with the crews that typically work on the wilderness?
Yeah, we're blessed to have a good rescue squad that's supported by the county, typically, and they get involved, lead up typically a lot of the rescues out there. A call may come in directly to them. It may come in through us or through our dispatch, but they're usually the first ones to respond to something. But with that said, if we do happen to have crews in the area, our dispatch will get a hold of us and send us to check it out. But yeah, shout out to the rescue squad out there. Really skilled, hardworking individuals, unpaid volunteer. And a lot of times they're getting a call at sunset and they have to go paddle half the night and, you know, to get to a group. And sometimes it ends up being a false alarm.
Right.
So some things to think about there, I guess, are, a lot of times those false alarms involve somebody that's checking in. You know, they have a significant other back home and they're checking in, whether it's a cell phone or a satellite type device. And then they just stop checking in partway through the trip to save battery is usually what they're saying. Even though they're fine, but then that gets their significant other pretty excited and they start making calls. And oftentimes that results in, you know, crews having to go in and check on them. So if you are headed in and you are going to establish a check-in system, just, you know, make sure everybody's clear. There's good communication there. Follow through. If you start checking in, keep checking in. Or, you know, just have some system in place, I guess. Another biggie is overdue parties.
Mm-hmm.
That gets, you know, wives really excited and they'll start calling. And oftentimes it's just due to, you know, the winds picked up for a day or two and they got pinned down and they're running late. Make sure, yeah, if you're going to head in, have a little wiggle room on that. You know, don't set a hard end date like, yeah, we're going to be out this day. I'll give you a call. And then they don't. And that will trigger, you know, a rescue type situation. So, yeah, give yourself a little wiggle room, good communication. Like I said, you know, the crews, the rescue squads, like I said, they're happy to be out there. They'll definitely come help you if you need it. But we want to minimize those false alarms because they're pretty busy. I mean, at any given time, any given day, there's some rescue going on somewhere up in northeast Minnesota, and those crews are busy. So we hate to pull them away from an actual rescue by sending them out on a false alarm.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, really important thing to keep in mind that, you know, if you are going to put those things in motion, that it is an actual emergency, because oftentimes those people, like you said, they're volunteers. They're leaving someone at home to go and do this, often in the dark of night, often putting their own lives at risk to try and help you. So before you set those wheels in motion, make sure that you are actually in an emergency situation.
I agree. And I think Tom had a great point is, you know, make that float plan or make that travel plan with, you know, with your party. And if you have a party of, let's say, four people, all from different walks of life, is make sure all four people in your party know what the plan is. As far as if you're going to check in each day via an InReach or a spot device or even a satellite phone, or if there is cell service. But make a plan with the folks that are staying home to guard the fire, so to say, and then follow through that plan. And on that plan, have options B, C, and D as well. You know, make it so if option A falls through, we're not going to raise the flag right away. You know, that the people at home, and I've more and more, I'm the one staying home guarding the fire. Mm-hmm. And so I think back when I was a younger whippersnapper and the things I pulled, and it's just like, ooh, that was probably really hard for my dad or my wife or my boss, where I wasn't checking in or supposed to be checking in because I just forgot or we changed plans. So I think having a really good communication plan, I think for some great ideas of how that plan should be laid out, I recommend calling our ranger stations, either in LaCroix or Kuishwi or Tofte and Gunflint. Our front desk folks are really experienced. They deal with people from all walks of life who want to go see and visit the Boundary Waters every day of the week. And so they may have some really good ideas of what you should be including in that plan, who you should notify. If you are with an outfitter, even better. If you're going to travel with your own personal gear, that's fine as well. But just, you know, make a fluid plan, but also make sure that plan works for what's going to happen.
Yeah. And to keep in mind that there are so many resources out there. The Forest Service website is a great place for information, and the information that you have access to when you get a Boundary Waters permit. Can't stress enough that people really pay attention to those and do that proper planning and have that proper communication with, like you said, the people that are back home expecting you to be back.
Yep. Nope. Totally. Totally.
So can you talk a little bit about some of the big changes that you've seen from your first experiences on the forest and in the wilderness to now? I mean, you talked about the type of gear that's being used. Any other significant changes that you've seen over your time on the forest?
Yeah. You know, looking back to my time back in 91, you know, mid-90s. I've seen some patterns. What I've seen is a lot of these more distant routes, the big loop routes going deep into the wilderness, aren't getting used quite as much. It seems like the patterns have shifted more to base camping, you know, just paddling in a couple of lakes to a hub lake, setting up, day tripping out from there. And that's great and all, but some of those lakes tend to fill up quite a bit. It can be tricky to find a campsite on those main entry point hub type lakes. So, I just got to put in a little plug for, there's a lot of great little single campsite lakes out there that, wonderful little campsites that hardly ever see use. Maybe just go a little further, head for that next lake. You're going to have great privacy, probably better fishing. You won't have to listen to your neighbors sing Kumbaya on the next campsite. I've seen a shift there. And it seems like also more people, they want, there's more tents on campsites. People like their own privacy. Yeah. I think back to 91 on working for the Forest Service, we doubled up in tents, and looking back to that, that was kind of weird. I guess they were kind of cheap back then. They didn't want to buy two tents. You see a lot of little tents, and that's why these big sites keep getting bigger. People, you know, these sites get raided, like, you know, the last episode talked about, and people tend to go for these nice big luxury sites because they have a lot of tent pads. So I've been kind of making a push in the last few years to open up a third tent pad on a lot of sites. Our old standard was always two 8x10 tent pads. I'm trying to get a third one in on a lot of these little backwoods lakes, just to kind of make them a little more palpable and take the pressure off the ones that are really getting pounded. So,
yeah,
those are probably the big changes I've seen, just not doing the big loops, more base camping. Yeah.
I mean, I agree with you, Tom, on that. I mean, I was a camp kid growing up, and I remember heading out for my first 2-week Boundary Waters trip, and we had six of us total, and we brought 1 6-person tent for six boys. And, it was July and like 75 degrees and humidity level was, I don't know, 135% humidity level and just, pretty close quarters. But I do agree with Tom. I think as been more of a push for a work-life balance in our work culture, that folks are wanting to go in the woods more, which I think is wonderful. And I have a lot of respect for people that want to spend their hard-earned days and nights off slapping mosquitoes around a smoky campfire. I really do. And I second Tom as well as saying, go a little farther and do it within your skill set. I think our closer lakes where a lot of folks are camping these days, you know, if you only have, let's say, 4 days of time in the woods, you know, and you want to try to do a base camp for a couple of days, go just a little farther if it's in your capacity. The results will be worth it. You'll see less traffic, better fishing, probably less noise as well. That being said, if you're a first time Boundary Waters camper or visitor and you're still kind of getting the whole camping / paddling thing kind of figured out, and it does take some time. It's a learned skill level that if you don't use it, you're going to lose that skill as well. By all means, you know, camp closer to home or base camp and do that. But, we're seeing the same thing Kuishui, where we're seeing a lot of visitors, which is wonderful, on kind of our closer entry point lakes. And the farther you get out, it's almost night and day as far as what you're seeing for travel patterns, to the point where, you know, we'll often on our last day on trail, we'll camp a couple lakes away from the entry point just to take that pressure off of those campsites for visitors and just do one big long paddle day back in. And it's night and day. And I said before, like, go a little farther out if you can. It'll pay dividends. I think also I've seen a lot more as well as cell phone use. And granted, I was gone for 10 years. So when I left Ely, cell phone towers and having reception in the Boundary Waters was just barely getting its foot in the water. I used to bring out the old, either a satellite phone or the old analog bag or Bible phones. And I'd have this car antenna and I'd climb a tree and like lean out to make a phone call to back to the base to check in each night and all that. And that was a real hassle. I'll be honest, real hassle. And so I'm welcoming this advent of some more technology in the Boundary Waters. I think on the flip side though is, in our everyday work life and home life, we are just inundated with technology. I mean, I have a work phone, a personal cell phone and computer screens and laptops and all that, as most folks do. And I've always looked at, even on a work trip, that going into the Boundary Waters is a really special place. And it's a really special place because we're not being inundated with technology 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So by no means, you know, don't discard those safety features of a spot device or an inReach, or a satellite phone, but put them down for a little bit. You know, you don't need to blog and take and use your phone for everything. You know, just, I really want folks to try to sit on a rock and just do nothing and just stare off in that lake, or, you know, hang out with a pine tree and just kind of, not to sound, you know, kumbaya, so to say, but I see so many folks even out in the woods or on their phone if they have reception. And I'm guilty the same way. If I have cell service in the woods, I'm going to check my email or my text and all that. But it's a great time to just like untether from that technology for a couple of days and just, you know, be you.
Yep. Yeah, that sparked a memory back in 91 when I started. The radio, the communication we had to check back in with the station was a pack set. It took 24D batteries. And looked like something out of Vietnam. You almost needed a backpack. And then he had to carry an extra 24D batteries for when those ran out. So yeah, I'm glad we've gotten lighter alternatives to that. Another thing I thought of that has changed. Remember bringing latex paint into the Boundary Waters, white latex paint. And we're painting birch trees that have been peeled on campsites. You know, some of the sites were peeled pretty bad. We're out on Lake One. And it was just kind of a social experiment to see what would happen if we, you know, put white back on them. And it worked. It took away the idea. People didn't have the idea to peel birch trees on. But a few of them, we actually tried to peel the paint out to burn it. But they don't do that anymore. But it was an interesting little experiment. Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, back on the point of cell phones, I think there can be too much reliance on cell phones for communication, for navigation. So the idea of relying on your cell phone to communicate with someone back home, there's inevitably going to be a spot in the wilderness where you're not going to have cell service. But also, your batteries can die. You could lose service. You could drop it in the lake or drop it in the latrine. So having those map and compass skills are crucial when you're traveling
good
in
point,
the wilderness.
Brett. Good point. Yep. No, it's a really good point, actually.
Yep.
Anything else you guys wanted to touch on while you're here? It's been a great wealth of information. I just wanted to make sure that we covered everything you wanted to talk about with us today.
Yeah, I could throw a little plug. We might have a early start to the paddling season here. Yeah. Possibly. I mean, things are kind of weird. A lot of weirdness going on this spring. A lot of the lakes are halfway out.
Right.
And they're just stuck in stasis like that. So it's hard to say if we're going to have a record early ice out or what's going to happen. But the temptation is going to be there to get out and paddle. Be cognizant that water is going to be cold.
Yeah.
So, that can get real sketchy real fast. People don't last long at all in that cold water. So I'm a huge advocate of paddling the shoreline. I mean, even in the middle of summer, I just think it's way more interesting if you can paddle a shoreline and you see more things. And if you do swamp a canoe, way better scenario for getting ashore. There's really no reason to cross the middle of a lake every time if you can go a little bit out of your way, paddle that shoreline. But have a plan in place for cold water. Have an extra set of change of clothes, you know, wrapped in plastic, waterproof. Think ahead, stuff like that. Can you think of anything else, Chris?
Yeah, I think a really important thing is wear your life jacket or your PFD. Wear it at all times when you're on the water. It'll be a little warmer in these early spring temps for you. It'll cut that wind and be a nice little insulation factor for you. And probably more important, if you dump over and you can't touch bottom, it'll help you float.
Right.
Or if you can touch bottom, but you hit your head when you dump over, you'll float. And that's really, really a key thing. And I'll be honest, when it's a hot July day or a hot August day, and it's like 85 and working hard, like, I hate wearing my life jacket. It's just, it's hot and you get sweaty and it gets stinky and all that. But I still do. Well, it's my job, but also I really believe in it. And with these cold temps, I had a couple early season trips last year up on Loch LaCroix with our heritage people. And it was, it was 55 degrees out, which is great if you're in your house and doing some yard work. But when you're out camping with a stiff wind and all that, I was wearing my PFD. I may have not brought enough layers as well, just full discretion on that. But I was wearing my PFD all day when we were paddling and also at night as well for that extra warmth. So it doesn't matter if you're an Olympic swimmer or if you have to still wear butterfly wings, I'll go in the pool, wear your PFD at all times in the water.
You can't underestimate that gasp reflex when you hit water. And that PFD, that life jacket, can literally save your life regardless of the season, regardless of how cold the water actually is. It's always best practice to keep that PFD on when you're on the water.
Very, very true. And also when you are wearing that PFD, wear it. Don't just have it like a vest and have it unzipped or unbuckled and all that. If you're going to wear the PFD, wear it how it's supposed to be meant. Zip it all the way up. Make sure your buckles are latched correctly and all that. And it's not an accessory. It's a life-saving device.
Well, and I've learned that as well, being a parent, having young children that I've taken out into the Boundary Waters. And You're their life raft if you go over. So if you don't have that PFD on, everybody's in trouble.
Yep. Yep. They're all going to try to glom onto you.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, gentlemen, thanks so much for all the work that you do and all the crews that you guys help manage. It really makes a better experience for everyone that's traveling in the Boundary Waters.
Thank you, Brett.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Tom Yankoviak and Chris Mayer. Pleasure to have you here on Forest North. Thank you for listening to Forest North, and enormous thanks to the crews out there helping to manage our incredible wilderness here in the northeastern Minnesota region, and our guests today, Chris Mayer and Tom Yankoviak, a key part of those crews. Thanks so much. Forest North is created by the Ely Tourism Bureau in partnership with the USDA Forest Service, Superior National Forest. Find out more about the Superior National Forest at fs.usda.gov/superior. Follow the Ely Tourism Bureau on social media at visiteelymn, at ely.org, and email your questions or comments to tourism@ely.org. Thanks again for listening. I'm Brett Ross. Join me next time on Forest North.